From NPR and WBUR, I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's Here and Now. President Trump is voicing more support today for the plan Republicans in the House have drawn up to replace Obamacare. That bill has dominated the week in politics, but there is much more to talk about as well in our weekly roundtable.
Joining us, Juana Summers, politics editor at CNN. Hi, Juana.
Hi, Robin.
And Rick Klein, political director at ABC News. Hi, Rick.
Great to be with you.
And Rick, start with the latest on health care. What are the tensions between the White House and Republicans, House members and other House members who are Republicans? I mean, especially today, we're hearing hints that the White House is saying they might make changes in the Medicaid rollback. So what's going on?
Fascinating dynamic, because you hear from the White House that, yes, they're willing to negotiate changes. But you hear from Capitol Hill, no, this is the bill. Paul Ryan out there in professor mode this week talking about it. And this is not a starting point as far as the House is concerned. But talking to several people that have stakes in this game and members of Congress as well, they feel like the White House is sending a much different signal. They're not clear that the White House even is 100% clear on what's happening on Capitol Hill. This becomes now a true test of Donald Trump as a legislator, a deal maker. Can he actually get something done, given all of the very complicated cross currents?
Well, that's my next question, Juana. Is it Donald Trump's health care bill or is it Paul Ryan's health care bill?
That is a great question, Jeremy. It doesn't seem like anybody on Capitol Hill or in the White House wants to own this thing. As you noted, House Speaker Paul Ryan, they've said Ryan Care. He's pushed back at that assertion. You've had a White House official say that President Trump doesn't want this called Trump Care. And I think that's one of the things that will make this bill perhaps a little bit difficult, although it does seem to be moving through Congress, is that it's really unclear who's taking ownership of it and its future. And regardless of who owns it, the fact of the matter is the Republican leadership and the president and have painted themselves a very narrow path, given that they have some infighting within their own party. They've got major health association groups that aren't lined up with them. That makes it really hard to do major overhaul like what the president and his allies want.
Well, here's House Speaker Ryan just today on the Hugh Hewitt radio show saying everything rides on this bill's passage.
This is momentum killing. If we don't do this and reduce or get rid of the $1 trillion tax increases in Obamacare, that just puts tax reform $1 trillion further out of our reach. So there's a lot that rides on this.
Well, and Rick, we've got some dollars being thrown around there, big dollars, but we still haven't heard from the Congressional Budget Office what this will cost, and we may soon, next week.
We don't know how much it will cost. We also don't know how many people would gain or lose coverage under this, which is pretty extraordinary. We've heard the White House say that they're already minimizing the impact of the Congressional Budget Office, that nonpartisan arm that gives these estimates. But they are going full steam ahead because they realize that time is not their friend. The more that this gets opened up for scrutiny, the more people ain't take aim at it, they will find things that they don't like. And this is a very complicated three-pronged strategy that the White House and Capitol Hill have put together, and they're seeing it fall apart, really, with people aiming from all sides.
You know, we spoke with Congressman Tom Garrett today, who is a member of the House Freedom Caucus, which is generally against this Republican plan, and I asked him if he thought it was possible that at the end of the day, they just end up with Obamacare because they don't pass anything. And he said, yeah, that's in the realm of possibility. Juana, is that possible that we just at the end of the day, they can't get together on these bills and it ends up with Obamacare?
I think what we're seeing right now is how it's very easy to come up with ideas and policy proposals, and that even when, as Republicans do right now, have full control of government, it's really hard to get things done like health care. And I think if you ask a number of the congressman's colleagues in the House Freedom Caucus, they say that the Trump bill is exactly Obamacare. It's Obamacare light, so not too much daylight between what President Obama did and what the president is suggesting now.
Yeah. Well, there have been some awkward moments, you know, in the discussion of this. One Republican rep asked, really, do men have to pay for prenatal care? This was during one of those overnight sessions. And of course, there was a lot of discomfort in the chambers there because that's an old conversation. Yeah, we all pay for everybody's health care. You know, that's how we do it. We pool it. And then there was another moment when House Oversight Committee Chair Jason Chaffetz on CNN's New Day was asked about how low-income Americans would fare under the GOP plan.
And you know what? Americans have choices, and they've got to make a choice. And so maybe rather than getting that new iPhone that they just love and they want to go spend hundreds of dollars on that, maybe they should invest it in their own health care. They've got to make those decisions themselves.
Now, Chaffetz later walked back some of these remarks, but people went crazy on social media. Rick, you probably saw people were posting pictures of their elderly sick relatives with their oxygen tanks and their iPhones, you know, indicating they needed both. Philip Bump wrote a column today in The Washington Post about how this is an old bugaboo, you you know, making it about the poor making bad decisions and that's why they're sick. And just your thoughts.
I think it's a misunderstanding of what it means to be working poor in America. And I think it showed bad judgment in terms of a comment to make. And I think where it becomes more problematic for Republicans is that this will impact people. There are millions of people who are now covered under Obamacare that will lose their coverage. There'll be winners in this as well, but there will be people that come out as losers. And there's no way to actually save money in the system and get rid of the individual mandate and rein in Medicaid without impacting actual people. Mm-hmm. And I've been struck by how much this has been about dollars and cents and numbers and big systemic things and not about individuals. And I think that's a problem in the salesmanship, because there will be names and faces associated with the people impacted by Obamacare, whether or not they have cell phones. This is going to be a big problem for people.
Mm-hmm. Okay, I know this feels like it happened a year ago at this point, but it was only last Saturday that President Trump said that he was the target, said that he had been wiretapped by President Obama. He didn't have any evidence to support that. And for several days in a row, White House spokesman Sean Spicer struggled to explain whether Trump was the target of any investigation. Here's Spicer yesterday in an exchange with Margaret Brennan of CBS News.
I'm not aware of it, but that's my point, is that we're not aware of anything. And
so
that's
you've never been told by the Justice Department that there is no investigation?
No.
So there might be one. You just don't know.
No, I said, you're right. I said I'm not aware, and we're not aware. And that's why we want the House and the Senate to do what the president has asked of them, to look into this. But no, we're not aware.
To discover if there is an investigation. That's part of the
to look into the situation.
Now, earlier in the week, Spicer said the president had absolutely no regrets about raising the wiretapping allegation. Juana, how is this playing out for the administration?
Well, from evidence of that clip, not very well. So far, the president is really out on his own on this. When you've heard Press Secretary Sean Spicer say that in his position, you know, that's not information he'd be privy to. Other White House aides and top officials saying that they don't have any information. Top leaders on both sides of the aisle of the intelligence committees have not brought forward any evidence to kind of substantiate the claims that the president made last week. And over the last week, we have not heard from the president on these claims since.
Haven't heard much from him at all this week, really.
That's absolutely right. I believe a couple of moments ago, he was meeting with lawmakers over health care, and a White House reporter attempted to ask him questions about this very issue and did not get a response from the president. So it's been a really quiet week for him. But I think there is certainly concern on both sides of the aisle that this is something that Congress should investigate. It's their job to figure out if, in fact, this happened. It is stunning. If, in fact, it did not happen, it is a sizable accusation against the president's predecessor, one I don't think we've seen the likes of in recent history.
Well, Rick Klein, maybe his aides told him that Twitter was broken, but it has been a quiet week. But to Jeremy's point, so much going on. It is a new administration, and that does happen with new administrations. But this week, the president also unveiled his revised travel ban. Six states promptly sued. And then EPA Administrator Scott Pruitt is being criticized for his interview yesterday on CNBC. He was asked whether carbon dioxide, as most scientists say, is a primary contributor. In other words, man-made pollution is a primary contributor to climate change.
No, I think that measuring with precision human activity on the climate is something very challenging to do, and there's tremendous disagreement about the degree of impact. So no, I would not agree that it's a primary contributor to the global warming that we see.
And Rick, not only that, somebody who is, you know, not in favor of his own agency, but this seems all these things seem to be under the radar.
Yeah, that's right. And I think that, yes, he puts him at odds with the official position of his agency. And I would think the vast majority of the employees at the EPA. I'm not entirely surprised by it just because of previous things that he has said about this. And I do think, and back to the point about last weekend, that is a big deal. And I think it was my colleague, Jonathan Carl, who asked the president a little while ago, any proof on the wiretapping? There was no answer. I don't think lack of answers should paper over the fact that what the president alleged, apparently without any evidence, was a very, very big deal. And whether it's Congress or the administration, both really, we shouldn't lose sight of that. And because there will be other flashy things that happen, and there's so much with his White House, they have shown that chaos is their brand, and they will continue to create moments around the edges. I think this is a big deal.
Well, speaking of lack of answers, the Secretary of State, Rex Tillerson, is apparently going on a trip to Asia next week with no reporters. Juana?
Right. I think this is just yet another example of how of seeing how this administration's relationship with the press will play out. Much like we're seeing the Secretary of State travel with no reporters, we've seen the president not take questions from reporters. And there have been questions of access, I think, surrounding this president and this administration since its onset.
Yeah, well, we got about a minute here. Rick Klein, you were talking about there might be other flashy, you know, shiny stories. What do you make of the CNN report that the FBI is still investigating an unusual number, something like 2,800 computer connections between the Trump Organization and a Russian bank?
Yeah, and we've heard about this computer connection in the past. It got people concerned during the campaign. There's also the revelation that Michael Flynn, the now fired national security advisor, was actually on contract working for the Turkish government. I feel like there's a drip to this story, and everything individually could have innocuous explanations, but there are serious things here, and I actually think the next week or two are going to bring some major revelations on all of these storylines regarding foreign ties of the Trump campaign and the Trump government.
Well, I don't know about you guys, but I now get up at 6 a.m. on Saturday morning. That's Rick Klein, political director at ABC News. Juana Summers, politics editor at CNN. Thank you both.
Thanks, guys.
Thank you.
Thank you.
As the bill to replace the Affordable Care Act, or Obamacare, makes its way through Congress, some entrepreneurs say the federal health insurance marketplace, you know, with the exchanges, has been a big help to them in the past few years, helping startup companies recruit and retain talent. Well, now some tech industry leaders are worried that could change. Ashley Lopez from Here Now contributor KUT in Austin reports.
Mason Hale started a small tech company in Austin about 6 years ago. It's called Swimtopia. It's a website that helps people manage competitive swim teams.
Most people aren't aware of like how complicated it is, but most teams are over 100 kids, and keeping track week by week who's going to be at the meet, who's not, what events they're going to swim, not to mention organizing all the parent volunteers it takes to run a swim meet.
Hale's startup helps keep track of all this for teams in about 40 states. But Swimtopia is still a small company. It has 6 employees right now, a mix of full-time and part-time. And like other startups, getting off the ground has been tough. Hale says it's a lot of work and a lot of risk.
And that's terrifying enough without having to worry about healthcare.
Before Obamacare, Hale's company was too small to get a good insurance rate for him or anyone he hired. But because of the law, the federal government created a health insurance exchange. It's been running in Texas for about 4 years now. Through it, insurance companies sell plans directly to consumers. It gives people like Hale the ability to buy insurance while they build a business.
It really gets down to this idea of personal freedom, like you have having the freedom to go start something new, to go take a risk, really kind of to pursue that American dream, where for a lot of people they're chained to their job because they have to have health care, or at least they were. And I'm concerned about the idea of going back to the way it was.
Republicans in Congress say they plan on repealing Obamacare. They've said they might replace it with something else. In the meantime, folks like Hale are afraid this could stymie innovation in places like Austin, which hosted a lot of startups during the Obama years. And the main reason is that Obamacare made it easier for people like Hale to recruit people like Andrew Eike.
I am a video game developer here in Austin, Texas.
Eike now works for a virtual reality startup. It's the second startup he's worked for so far. Before that, he says he used to work for Booz Allen Hamilton, a huge consulting company. Eike says it's only after Obamacare that he even considered working in startups.
That's one of probably the biggest factors that gave me the confidence to leave, you know, the safety net of Booz Allen Hamilton and go into the startup world.
Eike says a lot of talent has flowed through Austin since the marketplace started. He adds that being able to bring the right people in early makes those startups more successful in the long run.
Startups aren't just their founders, right? They're founders, and then they're like the first 5 or 10 people that are willing to quit their job and follow the founder.
Both Eike and Mason Hale say convincing people to leave behind their jobs and benefits and come work for a startup could get a whole lot harder if the option of getting health insurance is taken off the table. For Here and Now, I'm Ashley Lopez in Austin.
Well, we're reminded today of an important executive order. Executive Order 9066, enacted 75 years ago this week by President Franklin Roosevelt. Its stated goal, protecting the U.S. from spies. It gave the Secretary of War the power to create internment areas to hold people. Its effect, the forced removal of 120,000 people of Japanese ancestry from their homes to be incarcerated in camps, and more than half of them, 62%, American citizens born to Japanese immigrant parents. Here's George Takei, best known as Sulu from Star Trek, talking to us about his family's experience when he was just five.
My parents had packed hurriedly the night before, and I was looking out the front window, and I saw two soldiers come marching up our driveway. They had bayonets on their rifle. It glinted in the sun. And they stomped up our front porch and then banged on the front door. Hmm. And my father answered the door, and they ordered us out.
Well, during the last election campaign, then-candidate Donald Trump supporters pointed to the Japanese internment as precedent for rounding up Muslims. But in 1988, President Ronald Reagan signed legislation apologizing and offering reparation. The bill read, "The internment was caused by racial prejudice, war hysteria, and a failure of political leadership." Now, the Japanese American National Museum in Los Angeles has opened a new exhibit about the executive order, everything from Boy Scout items, kids brought to the camps, to a portrait of Senator Daniel Inouye, who lost an arm fighting for the U.S. in a segregated Japanese unit during World War II. The exhibit is called Instructions to All Persons, Reflections on Executive Order 9066. The original order, posted all over the West Coast, read, "To All Persons of Japanese Ancestry." Artist Clement Hanami is art director and curator at the museum. Clement, the order tells them to pack up a few items. The rest would be put in storage. There was voluntary evacuation at first. Then people were forcibly rounded up, as we heard. Is this a personal story to you?
Yes. My father was a voluntary evacuee from the very beginning. And he was a third-generation Japanese-American who was born in Idaho. So he was one of the fortunate ones in the sense that he had a family he could move to in Twin Falls. But for other people, they weren't as fortunate. The government did allow for the storage of some things, but it wasn't capable of storing all the belongings of 120,000 people.
And some of them came back and they were gone.
Yeah, they were either gone or stolen or just lost.
And others who weren't fortunate to have family went to these internment camps in Utah, you know, places that felt like another planet to them. Look, how do you think that family history maybe influenced you as an artist? And how are you and others at the museum exploring this through art?
Well, the exhibition itself has two artists included. One is Wendy Maruyama, and the other is Mike Saijo. Mike Saijo is an artist who uses books, and he uses those as a backdrop for much of his work. The painting that he has of Senator Daniel K. Inouye has a background of the New Testament. So during World War II, Japanese Americans were issued boots, guns, fatigues. But if you were a Christian, you were also given a New Testament, a Bible, to carry with you. So Mike Saijo has taken that book, and then he has taken the pages and glued them onto a background, almost every page. And then on top of that is a picture of the senator, Daniel K. Inouye, who lost his arm fighting in Germany. It is just an illustration of, for us at least, this idea of what it means to be Japanese American. You grow up learning about everything from, history, religion, civics, and you're taught to be an American until one day somebody says, wait a minute, you're not. And if you're going to fight for America, you're going to fight in a segregated unit, the 442nd in Europe, but you will be treated as a different group of soldiers.
Well, it's interesting you mention that, because the exhibit opened less than a month after President Trump issued his own executive order, 13769, prohibiting the entry of nationals from Iran, Iraq, Libya, Somalia, Sudan, Syria, Yemen. And the Iraqis, of course, had been fighting alongside the Americans against forces in Iraq and later against now, today, against ISIS, and they were barred from entry. So it's, as you said, you're with us until you're not with us.
Right.
Yeah. Does current history, or the current executive orders, the current consideration of banning Muslims, for instance, was that in your mind when you came up with this exhibit, or is it just a coincidence?
I think it's always been something that the museum is really wants to ensure does not happen again. We have hosted many Day of Remembrances here, which is basically a commemoration of the signing of the executive order, and we often collaborate with all different races, and most recently we've been doing quite a few with the Muslim community because of its relativeness to this whole story. So if you come to the exhibit, the first date in our timeline is December 7th, 1941, which is the bombing of Pearl Harbor. The last date in the many dates that we have is September 11th, 2001, and it is to make reference and connections to after 9/11, we saw a huge rise in Islamophobia and characterization of Muslims as the evil people. And so we wanted to make sure that what happened to Japanese Americans doesn't happen to other groups.
Can you describe some of the other items that are in the exhibit that sort of speak to the just the pain of this time?
So some of the more important things that we do have is a lot of documents, simple mundane documents that people would have gotten. They're very straightforward. They basically tell you, you know, these are the, you can only carry two bags. This is the room that you're going to stay in. Just these very simple instructions. But when you read them, you actually realize these are the instructions that people had to follow, which they were following as good Americans. Probably the most important document we have here is the original Executive Order 9066 that is signed by Franklin Delano Roosevelt. It's a very moving document for a lot of the survivors of the camps to actually see, because that was the signature that transformed their lives.
Wow. That's artist Clement Hanami, art director and curator at the Japanese American National Museum in Los Angeles. The new exhibit, Instructions to All Persons, runs through mid-August. Clement, thank you.
Thank you.
Hi, it's Jeremy Hobson, and I want you to take a minute right now to think about the people you love. Have they ever listened to a podcast? Do they even know podcasts exist? All this month, we're asking our listeners to tell a friend about a podcast they love. You can do it in real life or on social media. And if they don't know how to download a podcast, give them a quick lesson. You'll be opening up a whole new world for them. Tell us what you're recommending with the hashtag Trypod. That's hashtag TRYPOD. And thanks.
With a story about where to turn when your dog runs away, it's from our own Peter O'Dowd.
Look, if you've lost your dog, you can put 100 flyers on lampposts, reporter missing to the microchip company, and dutifully search the pound to console your weepy 6-year-old, or to console your weepy self. But if you're like me, you need something more. You need Jessica Lachlan.
The plight of the stray and abandoned dog has always just pulled at my heartstrings.
Jessica lives in Tennessee, where she runs a Facebook page for lost dogs in Arizona. It's called Straydar.
It was 2011 is when I first started it.
And if you lose a dog in Phoenix, you should go there and watch the drama unfold. That's what I did.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so you're going to go to Straydar. And if you could just type in my name into the search bar. It's Peter O'Dowd. Do you see a little picture of a little white dog?
I do.
That little white dog is Bisbee, my 10-pound chihuahua who dug a hole beneath my brother's backyard fence just before the Christmas of 2015. I arrived despondent at Straydar to post my digital flyer, and I found an entire city seemed to be doing the same thing with their own lost and found dogs. The pleas sounded something like this.
Hey, Macha's wearing a pink jacket. She's shy, so don't chase her.
I found this pug running without tags through Salido Park.
Oh my God, you guys, can anyone help? I just saw a truck hit this poor baby and drive away.
Is it weird that more than a year later, I still spend so much time on this website?
No, I don't think it's weird at all.
Well, thank you, Susan Taney. Susan started her own page called Lost Dogs of Wisconsin.
And then we have expanded this to be Lost
dogs of America,
which includes Texas,
Florida, Iowa, Minnesota, just to name a few.
Her page for Illinois, where she lives, has more than 120,000 fans. Many of them aren't even missing a dog, but they'll volunteer to paper a neighborhood with flyers, or they'll spend an extra hour at their computers cross-checking the animal control website.
So what they're doing is they're trying to make matches between a lost dog and a found dog.
So it's like a hobby of being a pet detective, essentially, for these people who have no stakes in this family's missing dog.
That's correct. But they do have a stake because it could be them the next time.
It's kind of a connection between all these different people that have all gone through the same horrible thing.
This is Theron Bartlett, whose border collie mix Anya is missing.
Probably her most distinguishing characteristic is she has one floppy left ear, but the other one sticks straight up.
I found a post about Anya on Stradar, and then I found Theron on Skype. Well, what is it about losing a dog? I mean, because the pain is real.
I think that's the biggest part of it. You know, I kind of grew up in a farming area, so I got used to, you know, death from a pretty early age. But disappearance is something entirely different. There's just this constant, you know, sense of worry and wondering. I mean, it's been 30 days after the fact, and I still wonder, you know, is she still out there? Has someone taken her? And it's the not knowing that gets you. That's the worst of it.
And that's how I felt until a little boy found my dog and returned her to us 7 days later, on Christmas morning, no less. I posted a picture of our happy reunion on Stradar, and more than 1,300 strangers responded. A good number of them praised God. Some praised the kindness of strangers. So I hold out hope that Theron's collie will make it home too, and I'll celebrate along with him when she does. For Here and Now, I'm Peter O'Dowd.
And it has not been a good week for the country's 911 systems. FCC Chair Ajit Pai says the agency is investigating why some AT&T wireless customers across the country were unable to call 911 on their cell phones on Wednesday night. Meanwhile, in Dallas on Monday, hundreds of people calling 911 were put on hold, some for as long as 30 minutes. One former FCC official tells the Wall Street Journal that there is an emerging crisis with the country's 911 systems. Ryan Knutson covers the telecom industry for the Wall Street Journal. He joins us via Skype. Hi, Ryan.
Thanks for having me.
Well, let's start with this AT&T problem that impacted people in and around Washington, D.C. Some in Florida, Texas, and Tennessee were also impacted. Is this kind of widespread outage common?
It's unfortunately becoming more common. This is something that in the past never really used to happen because the way the phone networks are designed, when it was all copper and everybody had a landline, everything was really localized. So if there was an outage in one part of the country, it was usually pretty small. It only affected one or two 911 answering centers. But now as the phone networks are becoming more digitized and they're connected all the way across the country, you can have these glitches like this where the 911 system can go down for hours and affect millions of people across the country. Now, we don't know what happened in this case. We don't know if it was a glitch or some other problem. But in 2014, there was an actual glitch at a server in Inglewood, Colorado, that caused a massive outage that affected, I think, about seven states for about 6 hours. In 2014, I think it was, there was an outage on T-Mobile that affected almost all their customers. So this is definitely something that is becoming more common where there are these big widespread outages that are affecting large swaths of the nation.
Well, and of course, a lot of people are going to wonder, especially given everything else that's going on right now, whether this was a cyber attack. You did some reporting recently on something that happened in October to the 911 system, thought to be the largest cyber attack against the country's emergency response system ever. Tell us what happened.
Yeah, so what happened was is there was a link that went viral on Twitter, and if you clicked on the link, then it caused your smartphone to start dialing 911 repeatedly, specifically iPhones, actually. It didn't affect Android smartphones. But teenagers that clicked on this link for whatever reason, they thought it was funny because it was so scary that, oh my gosh, my phone is calling 911 over and over again. 117,000 people clicked on this link, and that each one of those potentially spawned a few 911 calls. But dispatchers were overwhelmed with 911 calls that were flooding in. The peak of it was for a couple of hours on a Tuesday evening in October, and it was overwhelming 911 centers all across the country. And it seems like it was not an intentional cyber attack by a nation state actor. It was basically just teenagers that were causing this to happen. Mm. But it was something that people have been afraid of for a long time, and it finally happened.
So what are people saying needs to be done to the 911 system now that we are in an age of smartphones, which is obviously, as you mentioned, different than when it all used to be old copper wires? What needs to be done to get it up to snuff?
Well, there's a process right now to transition the 911 networks to what they call next generation 911. And that would hopefully allow people to have precise location data sent with their 911 call. Right now, it's pretty difficult to locate where the call is coming from when you're calling from a cell phone. You can't send text messages to most 911 centers. You can't send photos or videos. So there's this effort to modernize the 911 system, which is a very expensive and complicated process. And as part of that process, there is a lot of thinking being done about how to make the 911 centers more cyber secure. Part of what is envisioned is creating these sort of umbrella networks that would plug into regional 911 centers that wouldn't be every single one of the 6,500 roughly 911 centers would have to do their own cybersecurity program, but they could become part of sort of these regional umbrellas that would oversee them from that point of view.
I have one more question for you, and hopefully anybody listening to this will never have to use this information, but just in case, if you try to call 911 and it doesn't work, what should you do?
Well, one thing that it might be a good sort of security hygiene for people is to find out what the number is for the fire department and the police department and other emergency services locally in your area, like the 10-digit phone number to those places, and save that in your phone and write, you know, the name of it, backup 911 or something like that, so you can search in your contacts 911 so that if this ever happens where you dial 911 and you get a busy signal, at least you have another number saved and ready to go that you can look up.
That's Ryan Knutson, a reporter for The Wall Street Journal. Ryan, thank you.
Thanks for having me on.
Well, recent stories of vandalism and bomb threats against Jewish religious sites and organizations are part of a history of anti-Semitism. In the music world, one long-standing controversy involves a nearly 300-year-old symphonic work composed by the giant of classical music, Johann Sebastian Bach. St. John Passion is the subject of a lingering claim over the years that parts of the original work are anti-Semitic. As the Cleveland Orchestra prepares for a rare performance of the work, David C. Barnett from contributor WCPN IdeaStream explores its problematic past.
A Passion is a musical work composed for Good Friday church services for the purpose of illustrating the last days of Jesus Christ. As a prominent musician and composer based in Leipzig, Germany in the mid-18th century, Johann Sebastian Bach wrote numerous passions, but one of his most famous has been called anti-Semitic. Bach scholar Michael Morrison says many music lovers aren't even aware of it.
Many people nowadays don't know the Bible all that well, and very few outside of Germany know German, so they're not listening for the details of the story, they're just listening for the general magnificence of the piece.
And so they may miss the part where Roman Governor Pontius Pilate asks an angry Jewish crowd if he should set the recently arrested Jesus free. Bach has the mob shout, "Away with him! Crucify him!" Morrison says the St. John Passion is Bach's retelling of the biblical Gospel of St. John, which is even more controversial.
A key moment earlier in the Gospel is in John 8, where Jesus is depicted as saying that Jews are liars and killers by nature.
While Bach's language never gets that blunt, Jews are still cast as villains.
I think we have to make a distinction here between the person, Johann Sebastian Bach, and the genius, Johann Sebastian Bach.
Cleveland Orchestra music director Franz Welser-Möst says Bach and his work need to be seen in the context of life in Germany in the early 1700s.
And when you look at the history of Leipzig, it's very likely, and most historians agree on that, that Bach never met a Jew in his life.
Case Western Reserve University music scholar David Rothenberg says there are numerous examples of anti-Semitism in Western classical music, Richard Wagner being one of the most prominent.
He did not like Jews. He didn't like what they did to music. And we have writings of his, you know, penned under his name about this. And it's problematic because he wrote this music, which is in many ways great. He was a great dramatic musician.
In advance of this weekend's concerts, the Cleveland Orchestra organized a panel discussion about the issues raised by the St. John Passion. Rabbi Roger Klein of Cleveland's Temple Tiferet Israel suggests that such conversations can help modern audiences balance the musical beauty with the sometimes troubling text.
The piece itself tells us the truth, the greatness and glory of the truth of our world, and the deep and intractable problems. So we count upon our artist to tell us the way things are and not to cover over the parts of the truth which seem problematic to us.
The Cleveland Orchestra's Franz Welser-Müst says he's grown up with a problematic truth that can't be covered up, and that experience has reinforced his belief that we must confront and talk about art that reflects some of humanity's darker impulses.
Having had the Holocaust, where also my home country, Austria, has played a big part, that's baggage we won't get rid of. But it cannot mean that we automatically, out of politically very understandable reasons, we discard great art.
The Cleveland Orchestra continues the cultural conversation this weekend. It will be the first time the orchestra has played the St. John Passion in more than 30 years. For Here and Now, I'm David C. Barnett in Cleveland.
The FX show The Americans, the one about Russian spies in the 1980s, is back this week for a fifth season. The show features Kerry Russell and Matthew Rhys as the two spies. Here's Russell's character Elizabeth Jennings talking to their daughter Paige, played by Holly Taylor, about defending herself.
Mom! Mom, stop! What the hell?
First thing, you can't be afraid to be hit and you can't be afraid to hit, ever. You don't want to get hurt? You have to be willing to do anything to protect yourself. Put your hand up. Make a fist. Thumb here, always.
Well, joining us now is NPR TV critic Eric Deggans. Hi, Eric.
Hi, I was taking notes during that scene for myself. So
got to be ready to protect yourself.
And personal safety.
Right. So for people who haven't seen this show, just give us a quick update of where we are heading into season 5.
Well, as you illustrated in that clip, a lot of the storyline from this season is going to focus on the daughter Paige and the parents and them trying to manage her realization that they're spies. And she starts to have a romance. She's romantically attracted to the son of the FBI agent who lives across the street. So they're, of course, very concerned that she's going to somehow inadvertently reveal who they really are while she's over there hanging out with her boyfriend. And then there's also the question of what happens to the Russian agent who helped the FBI last season, who goes back to Russia, but now the CIA wants to turn him. So there's a lot of ongoing storylines that kind of get fleshed out. But I think the one that has the most potency is the one involving Paige and her parents.
And this show, I mean, I am in love with this show. I think it has been so good, even before, the politics kind of merged with what's actually happening in real life. But it doesn't do that well in the ratings. Why not?
Well, you know, the return was a pretty low-rated return. I think it was the lowest-rated return of the show yet. And I think part of the problem is that as a show ages, particularly one that has complex serialized plots like this, it is hard for new fans to get on board. So people may have heard about how good the show is, from critics' best of lists or from the Emmy Awards or the Golden Globes, and then they decide to check it out. And the story is so advanced that it is hard for them to sort of jump in the middle of it and feel like they're really understanding what's going on. Now, I got to admit, I'm in a camp of critics. I've never been as passionate about this show as some critics are. And, I think it's a good drama. But, it hasn't been on my best TV shows of the year list for several years because I've never responded to it in the way that a lot of people have. And so I think that might be part of it, too, is just the, you know, this story resonates with some people, but it is a small group of elite TV fans. Mm. And somehow they haven't managed to broaden the appeal of the show, even though it gets a lot of love from the press and it gets a lot of love in award shows.
And what about the fact that this show is happening at a time when we are seeing real storylines about Russia and the U.S. and spies and this and that play out? I mean, I'm thinking of House of Cards. They, a couple of years ago, created the President Petrov character, which was basically Vladimir mm-hmm. Putin, so that they could play out some of those storylines. Veep also has kind of veered close to reality at times in interesting ways that they didn't – I don't even know if they knew they were going to do. But what about that,
right,
that this is happening with all this going on with Russia now?
Well, I mean, what I've always found interesting about the Americans, one of the first pieces I did about it was the fact that it flips the script in terms of how Russia is normally portrayed in American TV and film products. Russia, in a way, is the good guy in this story,
right,
in the sense that the heroes that we're rooting for are deeply devoted to advancing the Soviet Union and its interests. And America is the evil empire that is shown developing a bioweapon. And there's another level for viewers, because we also should know as viewers what Russia really is, that it isn't necessarily this benevolent communist paradise that it is portraying itself as, and it has sort of indoctrinated these spies to believe it is. But it's sort of an odd juxtaposition, because we're ambivalent about how we feel about Russia in some ways, and we're questioning having a president who seems to be so admiring of someone who seems to be such a brutal ruler. And here we have this fictional show that is also forcing us to question how we position Russia as an adversary, or the Soviet Union as an adversary in the Cold War, and as a historic adversary of America. It's making us rethink all of these positions that we've had on the Soviet Union, at the same time that we're actually doing it in real time because of Donald Trump. And that may help make it a little more interesting for people who are watching the show now.
That's NPR TV critic Eric Deggans talking with us about The Americans, which is back on FX. Eric, thanks.
Always a pleasure.
So I haven't watched it yet. I'm going to get there.
I'm only on season two.
Right.
I'm on season two.
Oh, you've got a lot to catch up on. But it gets better, and it is worth
it. Can't wait.
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Jeremy Hobson.
Robin Young. This is Here and Now.